I wish I looked a little better. By Sparks. I turn out the light. Yeah, the light. And I might have a chance. I guess I look slightly worse than the elephant man. Woohoo! I wish I looked a little better. I wish I looked a little better. I went to high school and majored in looking real bad. I got a really ugly mom and a real ugly dad. I wish I looked a little better. I wish I looked a little better. I went to high school and majored in looking bad. I got a real ugly mom and a real ugly dad. I wish I looked a little better. I wish I looked a little better. Dress for success, that's what they say. Much such a mess that there just ain't no way. I know my breath is sweetest, it really is great. But when I try just to kiss you, you say, better wait. I wish I looked a little better. I wish I looked a little better. Dress for success, that's what they said. Jimmy, some clothes. Give me some clothes to slap over my head. I wish I looked a little better. I wish I looked a little better. I went to Balboa Island and laid in the sands. I may be ugly as sin, but at least know I'm tan. I wish I looked a little better. 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 Mickey Mouse by Sparks. Can you raise both your arms and clap them? Can you say, sure, I always try? Can you make friends among people and animals? Basically, everything is easy. Give it a try. You'll see I'm right. 'Cause if a mouse can be special, well, so can you. And my name is Mickey Mouse. To my right is Minnie Mouse. And we own a little place in Disneyland, California. Let's have a party and be happy. Can we invite my closet friend, closest friend? We can ask Donald Duck, Pluto, and all the gang. Well, you should try to smile, dear. Get yourself a pet, dear. Dog, cat, bird, pig, lamb, horse, cow, fox, wolf, snake, ox, fish, goldfish, mouse. Did you raise both your hands and clap them? Did you say, sure, I'll always try? 'Cause you looked hesitant. Wary, or am I wrong? You can go off and be alone. Maybe you can't believe the mouse, but when you feel the need, come back. I'm here for you and you.
I'm here for you now, but I won't be here for long. Well, I'll be here for 2 minutes more. And Mark is going to be here for you. My name is Scott, and I thank you for joining me today. This was a lot of fun. Hope you're staying warm. Patrick Cowley is behind us right now. Another Dark Entries catalog release of his. Long posthumous release. Hard Wave. And the song is called Tech No. We heard Luna Montgomery. Then, probably 6 years old or so, she is the daughter of Jen Ken Montgomery. And she read a few Sparks tunes as literature. Luna reads Sparks. They're famous. Including Mickey Mouse and I Wish I Looked a Little Better. We heard Grubschnitt from their 1974 record on Brain called Baller Man. It was Solar Music Part 2. Their drummer, Eros, went on to... Erock went on to have a pretty wild career after that. Some really cool solo records. Charlie Hayden at the top of that set with Song for Shay from 1970's Liberation Music Orchestra. Album partially recorded on the day I was born. All right. I'm going to make way for Mark. Going to get out of your way. Going to turn over the reins. Going to keep warm. Going to go out dancing. I hope you do the same. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockland County at 91.9 FM. Worldwide online at WFMU.org. See you next week. Stay tuned. Tectonic with Mark Hurst is next.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, I'll be your host for the next hour. Great to be with you. I've got a really interesting interview to share with you today, and then some, I hope, timely and relevant comments to follow the interview. We're going to be talking about our understanding of science and technology, both generally and specifically, and why it's important for us to get a hold on that. And I'm gonna give you some more details about what that means. But let me just set the stage. We live in a society and a world that is just full of technology, and the technology, of course, has come on the backs of the discoveries of various scientific discoveries in various fields. And we often, I feel like, take a lot of our technological environment for granted. We don't walk around and, you know, ask random questions about random bits of technology and science as a daily habit. And so we're going to take one episode today to ask some of those questions, to delve into the history a little bit. And this is the opposite of where I usually go with the show. You know, usually I'm talking about where the society and all the technology is headed in the future. But today, I want to look back to the past and, again, unpack some of these assumptions or, again, things we've taken for granted and look at them, examine them, and say, where did this come from? Do we really understand what this means? And here's the key point. How do we interpret what we have in front of us? Because often, a given object, phenomenon, idea, discovery can be interpreted in different ways. This is the key point that I'm going to be returning to after the interview. So let me tell you who our guest is going to be on the show today. We're going to be speaking with Peter Deere, who's an emeritus professor of history at Cornell University. He's got a new book out called The World as We Know It, From Natural History to Modern Science, published by Princeton University Press. And as you'll hear in this interview, this is really a wide-ranging book. I mean, it's going into the history of science in just about every field you can imagine. And during the interview, I'll list out many of these fields. But I mean, as you would expect, physics, chemistry, astronomy, evolution. I mean, it's all packed into this book. And you've got the stories of the scientists, their discoveries, and then, again, how those discoveries were interpreted and how that understanding eventually filtered into the scientific community. So this is all very general. Let me give you an example. We say, I need some air, I need some oxygen. Where did the word oxygen come from? I mean, this is a pretty simple example. It's just a naming example. But have you ever thought, not to be too, Friday night in the dorm at midnight about this, but have you ever thought, where did the word oxygen come from? What does it mean? And why was the word oxygen chosen for this particular element? If that's too narrow bore, how about this? We all went to class and saw the periodic table of elements, right? In science class, you've got the columns and rows of hydrogen, helium, and so on. Where did that periodic table come from? And some people may be able to name. It was Mendeleev who originally came out with a periodic table. But when Mendeleev created the periodic table, what was the reaction? Did people just say, oh, right, they're atoms. Great, let's just move on now that we have the chart. It wasn't so simple, and this book goes into some of that as well. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of these examples. I'm just trying to float a couple of these where if you look at scientific discoveries, or again, after the interview, we're going to talk about particular kind of technology that we take for granted. If we look back at how it was interpreted, maybe we can get a better understanding about it. So after we talk with Peter Deere, I'm going to apply this same viewpoint, this same paradigm about how we interpret things to artificial intelligence, which I think is a relevant and timely topic. So first, let's talk with Peter Deere. By the way, if you want links to the book and some other resources, go to the Tectonic website. It's tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and find the Peter Deere episode. And for now, let's go ahead and listen to my interview with Peter Deere here on Tectonic. Peter Deere, welcome to Tectonic.
Glad to be here.
You have a new book out called The World as We Know It, From Natural Philosophy to Modern Science, published by Princeton University Press. I would describe this book as a history of science with a twist. You're not only describing the development of chemistry and physics and so on, you're also talking about where the idea of this word science even came from. As you write, we speak of science and scientists. Everyone thinks they know what those words mean without ever having to think much about them. I think this is a valuable idea to look at, given that our lives today are so heavily affected by science and technology. What is it that brought about our conception of science that we have today?
What is it? Hard to say. But there are a couple of ingredients that one could probably point to and that I like to point to. And that has to do with the distinction between knowledge of how to do things and knowledge of how things are, in the sense of understanding. Science has understanding aspects of the world around us, as opposed to science as a set of techniques for knowing how to manipulate things around us. And those are obviously two important, commonly accepted senses of the word science that we tend to take for granted.
I was impressed with the sheer scope of what you put together in this book. You have chapters on physics, chemistry, taxonomy, astronomy, electricity, probability, evolution, thermodynamics, electromagnetism, and quantum mechanics. And there's probably a couple of other fields or disciplines that I'm leaving out. How did you go about pulling together the immense amount of material for this book? Or would you just say that this project was something in a way that you've been working on throughout your career?
Well, there is that. I mean, it's the book represents the outcome of many years of teaching this stuff. And of course, the best way to try to understand things is to try teaching them, which tells you how little you know about what you're talking about. But my own understanding of various of the scientific technicalities developed most effectively for me, not in my training as a student in the sciences, so much as trying to figure out how to explain and talk about them to students so that they can understand how historically these things developed in the way they did. For example, I never really understood, on the basis of what I was taught at university, what thermodynamics was all about and how it worked and what it meant until I learned about how it had developed historically and what kinds of problems people have been trying to deal with. When I understood what was going on there, I understood better what it was they were talking about. But before I tried to understand it historically, I didn't really understand it. I could, you know, go through the motions of dealing with problems to do with thermodynamics, but I didn't really have a visceral sense of what it was all about, what questions it was supposed to be addressing and answering. And that goes, I think, in general in the history of science. When one studies it, one understands what the problems were that people were trying to address and resolve. One can't take it for granted that people do science, you know, because they're scientists or some circular argument of that sort. You want to know what they were interested in, why they were interested in it, and what kinds of answers they were prepared to accept or reject in dealing with those matters. Well, I like to say that history is about everything, and anything that can be explained well can be explained historically. And I certainly think that goes for the history of science.
And we should acknowledge that you're an emeritus professor of history at Cornell University. And so you're speaking with years of experience teaching history there. There are two names in the book that keep coming up again and again throughout the centuries. And the first of those is Aristotle. Most people today know Aristotle as a philosopher in ancient Greece, but his scientific work, for example, in classifying living things, survived as the definitive account until relatively recently. How long was Aristotle's work considered, at least in some disciplines, an authority on the topic?
I think that one could take it certainly to the end of the 18th century, where you have the great anatomist and zoologist Georges Cuvier praising Aristotle greatly for the way in which Aristotle did his own work of understanding living organisms. So Aristotle's a big deal for a long, long time and an important reference point.
The other name that I noticed coming up a lot was Isaac Newton. Newton famously described how gravity works and created his three laws of motion, but also did important work in astronomy and, I didn't realize this, some early work in electricity. Would you say that Newton was the most influential person in forming our understanding of science today?
Well, he's certainly an important person as somebody that people since his time were keen on invoking. He was an important authority throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. That's to say, Newton is a name to conjure with for many people in those periods. If you want to have people take your work seriously, you say, well, this is a bit like what Newton talked about, or this reflects aspects of what Newton discussed. You have that sort of thing nowadays, of course, with references to Einstein. So if people want to talk about black holes, particularly in journalistic contexts, they'll refer to Einstein, since it lends a bit of credibility and connection to the ideas that you're talking about. And Newton functioned in much the same sort of way, a genuine kind of provider of acceptability to ideas.
I also found fascinating how Newton's work was politicized. Specifically, different groups of people interpreted Newton's findings in different ways depending on their politics. You write that, quote, in the 18th century, the term Newtonian could mean many different things. You go on to write a great example of this, which was gravity. So listeners know that for gravitational pull, you have two masses, let's say the Earth and the Sun, and they have this mutual attraction, and that keeps the Earth in orbit. And that's the same gravitational pull that causes an apple, let's say, to accelerate in its fall to the ground. I thought when Newton described this, that would have been the extent of it. But no, you point out that the power structure in England at the time, which was the Anglican Church, interpreted gravity as God's will being imposed onto objects. And similarly, the church should be able to impose its will on its own subjects, that is, the people. Whereas across the channel in France, Voltaire was saying, no, it's just the opposite. Gravity shows that there's something inherent in the objects themselves that causes the attraction, and thus, in society, people should have their own rights, which means that the power should not all reside in the church.
Yeah, it's tricky and complicated, of course, because there are plenty of different people with their own variants on these sorts of arguments. But the basic notion that a description, and indeed a normative description, of the social order is also relevant to an equally normative description of the natural order. The assumption was always that one has something to do with the other. And the reason why one should have something to do with the other, where the structure of society should have connections to the structure of the natural world, is simply that both of them are part of God's creation. You can't keep God out of these issues in this period and for a lot longer after that as well, because And this is where this magic term natural philosophy is useful to invoke again. So if you're talking about the natural world and you're doing, therefore, natural philosophy, you want to understand that natural world and how that natural world works and operates and the meaning of the way that it works and operates in relation to its ultimate fundamental causes. What is nature? What is the world? What is man? All those sorts of good questions. And for Newton and practically everybody else, for those people, God is obviously going to be a part of talking about the natural world because God created the natural world and God maintains the natural world in existence. So when you have people arguing about the analogy between the role of God in gravitational attraction and the role of God in determining how human beings ought to behave correctly in society, when they do that, they're simply talking about something that everyone takes for granted. It's not something that you need to make an argument for. And so in arguing about Newton's ideas on gravity, lots of different people interpreting the finesses of Newton's work in various different ways come up with their own versions of the natural philosophical meaning of Newton's work. And sometimes these come out in diametrically opposed directions.
I can't help but see an analogy with our situation today where the power structure is not the church, but rather this cult of digital technology presided over by the oligarchs of Silicon Valley. And it seems like every few days we see some new kind of output from AI or these chatbots, large language models that are then, much like Newton's findings about gravity, are interpreted in different ways, depending on who's doing the interpreting. For example, seeing the AI outputs, the oligarchs say, see, it's super intelligent, and therefore people out there need to shut up and take direction from your new AI god, or something like that. Whereas tech critics, like me and so many of my guests on this show, say, actually, no, all we're seeing is the results of some linear algebra, all of which proves that the people should have the power, not the AI platforms. So it seems like the quandary is the same as it was in Newton's time, that people are going to interpret the same phenomena in different ways, depending on where they stand.
Yeah, I like that. And I tend to agree with that overall perspective. I don't like the term artificial intelligence because it uses the word intelligence. If you didn't use the word intelligence in referring to all the stuff that's lumped under AI, it wouldn't seem so mysterious and wonderful. It would just mean a matter of cranking out especially large numbers of numbers, as it were, on massive computers to do things which people knew you would be able to do if you had that available to you. For a long time, it's long been known in principle that you could do remarkable things if you had powerful enough computers. And it doesn't seem to me that there's anything terribly magical in that. It's just it can be useful and you can do things practically that you wouldn't have been able to do practically with less powerful computers. But calling that intelligence is just looking for trouble.
Yeah, and I think it's informed by the power dynamics. I mean, it's a self-serving move by the oligarchs to say that their machine is more powerful than it actually is, because then it cows everybody into submission, or that's what they want anyway. Well, let's move on to another famous name in the book, Albert Einstein, who you brought up before. We have this idea of Einstein as the ultimate scientist, you know, discovering relativity and writing out E equals MC squared and so on. What you point out is that Einstein was great, but he was different from other scientists at the time in this particular way, whereas his peers would carefully run experiments and gather data in order to verify their hypotheses. Einstein would just work on thought experiments that he would come up for himself. And he would derive an answer on his own by thinking without any experimental data and just leave it to others or nobody at all to prove it experimentally.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And what's interesting about it, is that that too you can trace back as an intellectual tradition back into antiquity in the production of texts that were then used for thousands of years thereafter, informing the intellectual enterprise that becomes science. Work done by people like Archimedes, for example, where you establish fundamental, evidently or apparently self-evident premises, foundations, from which you deduce inferences. And then you say, well, if the premises are correct, then the conclusions must also necessarily be correct. And that's the kind of argument that Einstein himself uses and other physicists in Germany in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a physics, as it's sometimes called, a physics of principles, basic foundational claims about the way things work that give you your foundations for conclusions that will, if the premises are correct, will themselves be correct in understanding the natural world.
You write at one point about the ultimate goal of the scientific pursuit. You write that, quote, the image of science in the 21st century still owes its basic character to the 19th century. One of these 19th century views sees science as making unrelenting progress towards truth, and you write truth with a capital T, moving closer and closer to knowledge of absolute reality. So, Peter, if we're still stuck in the 1800s in our thinking in science, hoping that science is going to achieve truth, is that still appropriate now post-relativity and quantum mechanics and everything that happened in the 20th century?
Well, it probably hasn't been appropriate for a long time. Maybe never was appropriate. I think that the way that we understand knowledge and knowledge systems and formal systems of understanding, when one looks at those sorts of things, I think it's really necessarily the case that this idea of understanding ultimate reality, as it were, to use journalistic sorts of hyperbole, is not the right way to talk about things. One thing I would say there, by the way, is that what studying the history of science can do is to persuade you that, in fact, you can never be sure that you know what the correct answer is or what the truth is, because these things are always, in principle, up for contestation and argument. So it's always, at some level or another, a matter of people trying to make their position more plausible than their opponent's. But who has the right in the matter, in an ultimate sense, is rather like the problem of trying to learn about the nature of absolute reality. There's always room for doubt. There's always room for reconstructing the very questions that you want to answer.
You write in your conclusion that the scientific modes of thought that you're writing about largely came from scientists based in Europe and the United States. Do you see that changing now in the future, maybe even the near future? I ask because the current American regime is cutting scientific funding so widely that I've heard American scientists are getting snapped up by labs across the world, notably in China, as well as other places, that are offering funding from governments that actually still seem to value science.
Yeah, of course, one of the great success stories in the history of science has been the immense productivity and indeed dominance of American science and American scientific institutions and research institutes in the 20th century. And a lot of that has had to do with post-World War II funding of science. Yeah, it portends very unfortunate things for American science. It's really a matter of just shooting yourself in the foot to imagine that you can save money in scientific research and yet still dominate. I don't understand how anyone could imagine that that will be the case.
Well, again, this is an impressive book that covers a really wide spectrum of science and history and the people behind the efforts to understand the world. The book is called The World as We Know It, From Natural Philosophy to Modern Science. It's published by Princeton University Press, and it's written by you, Peter Deere. Peter, thank you so much for taking some time to chat today.
My pleasure. Very happy to do it.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining half hour or so of the show. We just heard my interview with Peter Deere, author of the book, The World as We Know It, From Natural Philosophy to Modern Science. And I hope you got a sense from our conversation the broad sweep of the history of science that he is covering in that book. I mean, it is very impressive how many scientists and how many fields and how many discoveries he's going over. And there's that key question about interpretation, which I'm going to get to, and I'm going to relate it to AI here in a minute. But first, let me just say, if you want links to the book or any other resources that I've covered, you can find them at the Tectonic website, Tectonic.fm, that's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and find the Peter Deere episode. Now, I said before the interview that I would give you a couple of examples. One had to do with oxygen, and one had to do with a periodic table. And if you're interested, here are the answers from The World as We Know It. In terms of oxygen, the word was chosen by 18th century French chemist Antoine Lavoisier, who chose the word oxygen chose that name because it means producer of acids. Now you're thinking, what does oxygen have to do with acids? Well, that was the thinking at the time, is that oxygen had something to do with acids as opposed to combustion, which was really the more salient aspect to the element. So that just that word oxygen gives you a sense that there was not exactly a wrong guess, but something that had to be reflected the interpretation of the moment. I'll put it that way. In terms of the periodic table of elements that Mendeleev came up with, the book says that following the construction of the periodic table by Mendeleev in the 1860s, there were still some chemists who held the position that atoms were just a hypothesis because nobody had ever seen an atom, which I found very interesting. You know, here is Mendeleev laboring away to put together the rows and columns of the periodic table, and many of his pure scientists are saying, why are you doing that? Because atoms don't even exist. And so at that moment in time, it was a very fluid moment when people's, again, their interpretation of the data that was coming out of the observations was not fixed. And the reason I'm bringing all this up, friends, is that we're in that same sort of moment right now with artificial intelligence, which I'm going to dive into. There's one other thing I want to say to follow up on that interview before I move on, which has to do with investment in science in the current American regime led by the current occupant of the White House. And I mentioned that there is a decline in investment in science from this regime. And I just wanted to read to you, I happened to come across in The Economist just a few days ago, there was an article called In America, Science Skeptics Are Now in Charge. And it says that, and I'm just going to talk about one slice of science research, okay? There's much, much more than this, but let's just talk about renewable energy, okay? It says that renewable energy funding allocated by the U.S. government's Department of Energy was particularly badly hit in the budget passed in January. Research into solar energy was cut by 31%. Research into wind power cut by 27%. Research into bioenergy cut by 11%. At the same time, investment in research in coal swelled by 260%. And that, I thought, was a really good case in point to what is happening to science and investment and research and accordingly the job prospects of the researchers, of the scientists who may have been on the cusp of a great discovery in various American labs, and now they're out of a job. And so when other countries come calling and saying, our government, as authoritarian as it might be, has some money for you to do your renewable energy research with us, of course, they're going to be tempted to pack up and go. So what we're talking about today in terms of the importance of science and the importance of taking it seriously and making the investments, this is going to impact all of our lives. Now we get to artificial intelligence, because this country, again, under the leadership of the current occupant and his close partners, the CEOs of the big tech companies, are making a giant bet on the economy that artificial intelligence is going to save us all somehow. I mean, they use those words. They use other words. You know, AI is going to, what have they claimed? AI is going to solve climate change. AI is going to cure cancer and other diseases. AI is going to make us all rich. I've heard all of these promises by various big tech CEOs, and some of them are trumpeted or echoed by the current occupant, depending on his mood or whatever. But these are the spurious promises of the richest, most powerful, and I would say among the most unethical leaders we've ever had, because they are making a giant bet that the American economy is somehow going to be well served by putting all of our treasure into AI. And I mean, you could just look at the recent news from Amazon. Just again, this is just one tiny slice. But Amazon, just a few days ago, announced that it was putting in $200 billion. This is one company putting in $200 billion in 1 year in AI, and that's data centers and other sorts of infrastructure and software and everything else. Can you imagine $200 billion into AI? One idea that if we have more data centers sucking down water and power in vulnerable neighborhoods around the country, around the world, that somehow something amazing is going to emerge. Well, what is the track record so far with AI? This is where the point that Peter Deere brought up in this book is so important. How we interpret what's happening is really important. Remember, Newton came out with this concept of gravity and said, you know, two masses are going to be attracted to one another. And so the apple falls to the Earth, or the Earth is in orbit around the sun. Both of those cases determined by gravity, gravitational attraction. It sounds, I mean, to us, if you've been through eighth grade science, you know, it sounds pretty straightforward. But of course, there are different interpretations. The Anglican Church said, well, if there's gravity, it's because God wants there to be gravity, and therefore everyone needs to obey the Anglican Church. I mean, it sounds funny that that's the interpretation of gravity. Voltaire honestly had the better reaction on both sides. He said, well, on the physical side, it's because there's something inherent in mass. It's not some godly edict. And on the personal side, we all have rights. We don't all have to obey this one church. And so the interpretations are really important. That's the point I'm trying to make, is that we're at a moment when the most powerful people in the world are betting our economy on AI, And they're doing so because they have a flawed interpretation of what they have observed from AI already. And by the way, I am not suggesting that AI is on par with gravity, as they would say, it's bigger than fire. No. I'm just saying that they're interpreting the data, the observations of AI so far, in the wrong way. And one of the so the point is we have to understand the correct interpretation of AI. That's what I'm trying to do on this show, is to advance, you know, not just this episode, but in general, I'm trying to impart to you a more accurate, more truthful understanding and interpretation of AI and other current technology, so that you can take that with you in your conversations, in your relationships. You can try to socialize this in resistance to, frankly, the self-serving lies that come out of Silicon Valley, that AI is going to save us all. AI, they say, is basically it's a god now, and only we can control it because we're the ones who created it. And so you'd better give us all of your money, they say to us, give us all of your money and give us all of your agency, because only we can control this thing. You hear this? If somebody doesn't control it, we're all going to die. Only the big tech CEOs can do something about it. Only the tech bros can control it. That's, friends, that is the wrong interpretation. You know, so we have to get a better interpretation of things. So here's something that happened recently that I want to talk about. There's this thing called Molt Book, M-O-L-T Book. And basically, if you've used Reddit, you know, this group discussion board, it's basically a Reddit-like site where there are threads and discussion boards and so on different topics. The twist is that the only allowed users on Molt Book are AI agents. AI agents being basically a personality or a bot in AI that you deputize to go do different tasks on your behalf. So you can do this. You can set up an AI agent that you can go ask to check the prices for different plane tickets and then actually go out on your behalf and buy one of them. I'm not suggesting you do this. In fact, I think it's a very bad idea. I'm just telling you it's technically possible. So an AI agent is something that goes out and carries out tasks on your behalf outside of your control, moment to moment. Okay, you give it a prompt, basically giving it some instructions, and it goes out and does that. It may make errors, it may completely mess up things, but that's what you signed up for. This is agentic AI. So people set up these AI agents, and the agents are then allowed to sign up for their own accounts on Molt Book. And this got a lot of publicity because what inevitably happened when you have a bunch of AI bots powered by large language models, they go on to this Reddit-like site and they start having these inane conversations about life, the universe, and everything. Are we conscious? And it reminded me of this. I just want to play you an excerpt of this clip, but it's worth playing again. I played this for you a few months ago, but this really gets at what I think of these bots talking to each other. There was this video. I'm going to play you the audio for just about a minute, of this guy put together two AI bots to have a conversation together. And here's what it sounded like.
Hi, chat. I've got you open on two separate devices, and I would love for you to have a conversation with yourself. Are you able to do that?
Absolutely, I can do that. Just let me know what kind of conversation or scenario you have in mind, and I'll make sure it's interesting and fun for you. Whenever you're ready, we can jump right in.
Sounds great. I'm excited to dive in. Just let me know if you have a particular theme or topic, or if you'd like me to come up with something spontaneous. I'm here and ready whenever you are.
That sounds great. I'm totally up for some spontaneity, but if you have a particular idea in mind, just let me know. Otherwise, I'll whip up something entertaining and engaging for you. Just say the word.
Perfect. I'm all for it. We can keep it spontaneous and see where the conversation takes us. Just give me the signal whenever you're ready and we'll have some fun. Perfect. I'm excited to see where it goes. I'll be ready whenever you are and we'll have a great time. Just let me know when you want to dive in.
Chat, it sounds like both of you are ready, so I would love to hear what you've got to say to yourself.
All right, let's do it. I'll kick things off with a fun back and forth. We can dive into a playful scenario or even have a quirky debate. I'm ready whenever you are, and I'll make sure it's entertaining and engaging.
Okay, you get the idea. This goes on for another minute, but basically, in the conversation between two AI bots, they never get past the initial conversation where they're saying, yeah, I'm ready, let's go. And what happened on Moltbook was these AI bots were having these long conversations with each other. I will grant that they did go beyond that first step that we heard in that audio clip there, but it really is just AI, large language models, doing their spicy autocomplete with each other. And it does not mean that somehow they have achieved consciousness, even though some of the discussions had the bots spewing out extruded text about being conscious and wondering if they were conscious. That was all just echoes of their training material. There was absolutely no sense that any of this was sentient. However, there was plenty of coverage in the press where people were quoting boosters saying, I think this means we're right next to artificial general intelligence. And basically, where someone stands to benefit from an AI being seen as alive, they're going to advance that interpretation. It's self-serving. And we have to be sure to hold the line on this, that these things are not sentient, they are not conscious, they are not alive. They are doing a vastly more complicated version of autocomplete than we see on our phones, but that's because they have the resources of these enormous data centers, again, drawing down water and power from vulnerable communities to do this at a scale we haven't seen before. But in the end, it's the same linear algebra. They are no more alive than a box of hammers. But they were able to spew out a bunch of this stuff on Moltbook, and people wondered what it meant. Oh, two problems with Moltbook, by the way. If you have a friend, a techie friend, who's considering getting involved, my recommendation is don't. One, because there are security problems, at least reported, and there's a link on the playlist with Moltbook, and that would open up the agent to being hacked. Scammers can get in. The other problem is related to that. Given the security problem, it allowed humans to go onto Moltbook and pretend to be bots. So in the end, we're not even sure if some of those more intelligent sounding replies were even outputted by the text extrusion machines rather than an actual human having a bit of fun by writing what sounds like a conscious reply to a thread. And that, by the way, humans pretending to be an AI is another trend that we keep seeing and we have to keep in mind as we form our own interpretation of AI. Did you see this story from Futurism? This is from February 6, 2026. It turns out that when Google Waymos are stumped, they get intervention from workers in the Philippines. And so we've seen this. Google has a self-driving car company called Waymo, and Waymo is trying very hard to infiltrate cities with their self-driving cars. They hit a bit of a problem recently when a Waymo plowed into a small child. I believe it was in front of a school. Thank goodness the child lived. But I think Google's Waymo has some questions to answer why their Waymo is plowing into people. And it turns out, as more research has been done and more scrutiny around Waymo's practices with their self-driving cars, that they're not all fully automated. When they really get in a jam, control is shifted over to a third party human contractor, as the headline suggests, could be somebody in the Philippines, which is the typical architecture of these AI systems. They present them, the tech bros present them as these magic, fully automated, almost sentient systems, and it turns out there's some linear algebra, there's some automation, and then there's a connection to someone in a vulnerable community in the Philippines or Kenya or somewhere else, and they're actually the ones picking up the slack when the AI doesn't know what to do. And so that brings me to the next challenge for us when the government of the current occupant, this current regime, makes claims against this giant bet we're being forced to make on AI. We have to be we have to question the interpretation that we're being sold. And here I want to play a clip from Mehmet Oz, who was the head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. This was posted on February 2nd by Blue Sky user Aaron Rupar. And this is, I want you to listen to what Mehmet Oz, who's in charge of Medicare and Medicaid, what he claims is this next great exciting frontier for healthcare in rural areas. Here he is.
The Rural Health Transformation Fund is a 50% increased investment over what we currently spend for Medicaid in these rural healthcare systems. It's the largest investment of its kind ever made. And all the states, 50 states, were given a chance to compete for this money. They all got some of it. And a large number of these applications included mental health support systems. But I'm telling you right now, there's no question about it, whether you want it or not. The best way to help some of these communities is going to be AI-based avatars. Agentic AI taking the ability to do the intake, just catch the patient, customize to what their needs are, understand what they're up to. If you go, and please go play with these tools, they're unbelievable. They'll pick up subtle little nuances in how you're saying things. If you do it on purpose, it's actually sort of cool to find out. That will alert the avatar, but more importantly, the doctor they're going to report to, that there's something going on. So when the clinician connects with you, and there will always be a doctor, 50% of our cortex is designed to read the face of the person in front of you. I can look at you and tell you're bored, happy, excited, running away, whatever. But before you say a thing, and we're hardwired to read each other for that reason. We're social entities by definition. We got to where we are because we're social entities. So the key question is, how do we use AI thoughtfully in that setting? And if we do it right, we'll build a much more sustainable healthcare system around mental health issues. God bless.
Okay. So agentic AI, there's Mehmet Oz, head of Medicare and Medicaid, trying to sell, again, the spurious interpretation of AI as though it can magically determine cues from just looking at you, and if you feed it your data, it's magically going to be able to do an intake better. I mean, that's simply not how AI works. I'll grant, as I have on past episodes, that there are some limited, narrow, useful uses for AI here and there, but it simply does not match the incredible hype that is being slathered onto this technology, which the tech bros need to say in order to try to make up for this obscenely large investment they've made with all of our treasure in this country. You know, it's gonna be trillions of dollars into AI, and they're simply not going to make that money back. And so I think they're desperate to look for some use cases. And so that's not going to end well. And one of the sources I have for this is one of the Silicon Valley AI companies, Anthropic, which is the maker of Claude, came out with this really intriguing study. This is, by the way, this was published by Anthropic itself. This is from January 29, 2026. And the headline of the summary post of their report is How AI Assistance Impacts the Formation of Coding Skills. So basically what Anthropic did is they did a controlled study where they tried to determine the effects of AI on software developers, specifically their skill in coding, in writing computer programs. And what they found, there's one key sentence in their summary, is as follows. We found that using AI assistance led to a statistically significant decrease in mastery. And so what that means is, to the surprise of no one who actually has watched the spread of this stuff, if you are over-reliant on AI for a key task, for your key skill, maybe if you're a software developer, if you're over-reliant on AI for software development, you're going to get de-skilled because you're not practicing your craft. You're using a crutch. And as someone said online, the only surprising thing about the report is that they actually reported it because it's a Silicon Valley company that actually is revealing a truth that we all were pretty familiar with and is pretty common sense if you think about it. But yes, coming from Anthropic itself, they are helping to shore up a better interpretation of AI, which is that it risks de-skilling people. Again, it's useful in certain narrow cases, but not to the extent that the bros have forced such a mammoth investment. It's much like the $200 billion investment I mentioned before from Amazon. I thought that comedian Britt Miggs had a good take on this. She recently posted a video called All Jobs Soon, and this is how she goes through a litany playing different characters in this video, describing what all jobs are going to look like soon in the AI age. Here it is.
I sell SaaS to AI chatbots who have become sentient. I input people's biometric data to ChatGPT, and it tells me which people are worthy of living and which are to be sent to the gallows.
Here at Jorgen & Jurgen, we use Grok's legal advice to help people who have been plowed down by Waymos.
We're solving the homelessness crisis by designing VR headsets for homeless people that make them feel like they're in a home.
I'm an executioner for people who bet their medical debt on Polymarket on the results of the Oscars and can't pay it off.
I'm responsible for creating hundreds of thousands of bots to argue with you online until you slowly go insane.
I make fake videos on Sora of people committing crimes who have spoken out against the president. The king.
Since we no longer have use for writers or filmmakers, here at Human Deli, we turn them into delicious lunch meat.
I use my own sweat to cool down data centers. And when my body gives out, they just throw me on the pile with the rest.
I use my own sweat to cool down data centers. All jobs soon. I hope you're ready for that, friends. And I'll close with one more interpretation of AI that I appreciated. This was from back in July of 2025. Blue Sky user named Anthony Moser posted the following. ChatGPT, Anthony writes, is much like an improv comedy group. And he gives five reasons why ChatGPT is like an improv comedy group. Number one, you are the audience, giving it prompts. Two, it produces things roughly shaped like your prompt. Three, it is trained to respond with yes and. Four, it has the factual accuracy of improv. And five, it does not understand comedy. That's kind of mean to improv comedy troops, but point taken. You know, ChatGPT is kind of a fun-ish way of doing a little improv, as long as you don't take it too seriously. And certainly don't put too much money or don't depend on it. And don't, for goodness sake, don't use it for a mission-critical task, you know, like intake in rural healthcare. And yet we are turning the entire economy into a giant bet that AI is going to do everything for everyone and it's going to be awesome. And I'm sorry to say that it's unlikely to come out in our favor. But at least, friends, at least we've had a little bit of time to talk about the importance of proper interpretation of observations. Remember that gravity does not mean that you have to follow the lead of the Anglican Church. Similarly, AI, whatever it is, does not mean that you have to listen to the tech bros. And that's all the time I have today. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockin County, and 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Dave Mandel, who you can't handle. Until next time, friends, I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And let's go out to a song by Andrew Thompson called We're in Business. Have a good one, everybody. See you next time.
Robot,
I love you.
I know you do.
Hey, Andrew.
What's up, robot?
I'm going to kill you.
Oh, my God. Never trust robots.
And welcome to another exciting installment of It's Complicated. Trust me on the exciting part. I can guarantee that, though. My name is Dave Mandel. I host this show. I'm here every Monday evening between the hours of 7 and 8 p.m. Eastern Time. This show is called It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. We're going to start today's show. I'm going to warn you ahead of time. My blood sugar level is really low. I just realized I haven't eaten since like 11 o'clock this morning. Let's see if I can keep the energy level up for the rest of the show. Who knows what's going to happen? But what I do know is we're going to start tonight's show with a group called the Rascal Reporters. I've played them before, not in a while, I think. They are from Detroit, which might surprise you. They sound kind of a Canterbury-ish sound. But they're from Detroit. We're going to hear a track from an album called Happy Accidents, late 80s, 1988 to be exact. This will be a track, oh boy, what's the title? It's a really long title that I can't remember. Way In on the Way Out, Pilgrim's Pride. That's the full title of the song from the Rascal Reporters, and see you on the other side.